Campus FM presents a talk organized by the Aqda Studentita Teologija entitled Faith and Reason According to Cardinal Newman. This talk is delivered by Reverend Professor Thomas Norris.
Good evening to all. On behalf of the Dean of the Faculty of Theology and on behalf of the Department of Fundamental and Dogmatic Theology, it is my pleasure and my honor to introduce Reverend Professor Thomas Norris. Yesterday he delivered the Aquinas lecture at Birkirkara on reason and the classic experience and in St. Thomas Aquinas. This evening he will be lecturing on faith and reason according to Cardinal Newman, a very topical subject given that Newman will be beatified later on this year. Reverend Professor Thomas Norris is lecturer in systematic theology at the Pontifical University of St. Patrick's College, Maynooth, Ireland. He is also a member of the International Theological Commission. Besides other duties he has, he is author of various works, some of which are also present here, and if anyone is interested afterwards, one may perhaps purchase a copy. Professor Norris was also a member of the Irish Episcopal Commission for Catechetics, Ecumenism and Theology. He is currently Joint Secretary of the Irish International Interchurch Meeting and was also a member of the subcommittee that drafted the ITC, the International Theological Commission's Memory and Reconciliation document of the year 2000. I won't take more time out of the time allotted. So, Professor Norris, Faith and Reason According to Cardinal Newman. It's our pleasure to listen to you.
Well, thank you very much, Father Hector. And let me say again how delighted I am to be here in this eminent and wonderful island and at this noble university of Malta. And to have this opportunity to share with you some of my insights into John Henry Newman, who is in fact perhaps more known in the world now than ever before, whose star, as it were, continues to rise, and who is remarkable in three worlds: the world of theology, philosophy, the world of literature, as he's considered to be one of the greatest writers of the English language in history. James Joyce and Oscar Wilde carried him books of his around with him for the style, to see the style of the English, and of course then also as an educationist as well. So a university like this deals with all those subjects. But I'm particularly happy to meet people who are interested in studying philosophy, theology. I talk about the great theme then of faith and reason in Newman. Newman is not only somebody who has a lot to say about faith. He was a practitioner of faith. He was a man who traveled an enormous spiritual journey, and the church now has recognized after all the years that he succeeded in this journey, that he is among the blessed. Those fulfilled Christians who reach a special level of union with God and who can be proposed to their fellow Catholics and Christians as models and examples of Christian life. However, he almost didn't begin. As a teenager, he was a very precocious, clever teenager. He was very attracted by, you know, free thinking, even a touch of agnosticism. And at the age of 16, and that's why he's significant, as a teenager, he went through, in the summer holidays, the president of the college where he was studying gave him a few books to read over the summertime. And these books had a huge impact on him. And it led to a huge discovery of God, of Christ, redemption. And these truths burned into his soul. So he traveled a huge journey, described by Pope Paul VI as the most toilsome, but also the greatest, the most meaningful, the most conclusive that human thought ever traveled during the the 19th century, indeed one might say during the whole modern era. In other words, a huge journey that he travels, you know, from the edge of, unbelief to the heights of a life based on faith. The unfolding drama of his faith life gives his long life an ecumenical dimension then, because he began as a kind of low church Anglican, then kind of middle church, then a great leader in the Oxford movement, which is high church, then becoming a Catholic midway through his life. As you know, 1801, 1890 are his dates. 1845, he becomes a Catholic. Never was a mind, therefore, so unceasingly in motion, but the motion was always growth and never revolution. So the journey of his life was always one of growth. He was discovering new sectors of reality, segments of faith as he went along. And so that great mind and soul expanded out to include totality, a kind of a fullness. Besides, his range of enterprise and engagement was a rich variety. Sometimes he's writing as a controversialist or a theologian, other times as a pastor or a guide to those seeking guidance in their very personal journeys of life, still other times as a friend of people. He didn't live in an ivory tower. When you read those books, you think that this man, you know, must have been in a library all the time. No. Newman wrote many letters every day. The collected letters amount to 32 volumes. So he lived, in as he said, somewhere in his friends. So he's anything but just a bookworm, is a term we use in Ireland. He's anything but an ivory tower figure. He's a man who lives in the middle of life with people, and he has a great love for people, and loves exchanging letters. Of course, the Victorians were great at letter writing. We now have invented the email, so we can continue to write quickly to our friends. What I'm going to say here attempts a formulation of his teaching on faith as a Catholic. Then it will consider faith as a principle of action in the life of believers. Next, reverting to his life's itinerary, we will look at the Oxford University sermons, where he deals with this theme of faith. And then in the final section, we look at his thinking as a Catholic on the topic of faith. One may locate the central axis of Newman's whole life in his very deliberate decision to follow Christ. In that conversion at the age of 16, he was struck by a phrase, holiness before peace. In other words, achieve the ideal of Christianity or burst. Make it or die, almost. You know, so he set himself, even as a young teenager, now remember, he was probably a very precocious one, and maybe people in the 19th century had to mature very quickly. They often went off to university at the age of 16 anyway. So he set himself to this great ideal. But he was aware, as a young believer in England, of a great turning against belief, against faith practice, and so on. And so he felt that he would be called upon to give an account of his own faith. So first of all, I want to look at the basic definition that he gives of faith from the Catholic time in his life, a Catholic definition of faith. You'll find it in his work called The Discourses to Mixed Congregations in 1849. And he describes faith there in these terms. Faith is assenting to doctrine as true, which we do not see, which we cannot prove. We assent because God says it is true, God who cannot lie. And further than this, since God says it is true, not with his own voice, but by the voice of his messengers, faith is assenting to what somebody says, not simply viewed as that particular person, but to what he is commissioned to declare as a messenger, prophet, or ambassador of God. End of the quote. We'll notice at once in this definition that the object of faith is God and the doctrine that God has made known through his selected messengers, prophets, ambassadors, or apostles. Faith is by its very constitution then a work of God, God speaking and communicating himself to us. It is not primarily the result of our own thinking. We do not see, we cannot prove. Faith, in other words, is not imminently generated knowledge. It's not generated from inside ourselves. But it is the result of the action of grace and the gift of the Holy Spirit. If you have faith, it means God has worked in you and the Holy Spirit has touched you. God has loved you in a special way to have faith. It's a beautiful insight to come to. Even if you feel you have little faith, The fact that you have some means that God has touched you in your life. Faith, in other words, is not this imminently generated knowledge, but it is the work of God in you. So faith has two qualities or peculiarities. First, it is most certain, decided, positive, immovable in its assent. And it gives this assent not because it sees with the eye or sees with the reason, but because it receives the tidings from one who comes from God. So it is certain, and it is certain because it knows that the mouthpiece of the message is from God. And in his typical pastoral style, of which he was a master, Newman goes on at once to illustrate his teaching by reference to the apostles, who as ambassadors of Christ handed on to others what they themselves had received. And here are his words. The apostles preached to the world that Christ was the Son of God, that he was born of a virgin. Could the world see all this? Could the world prove it? How then were men to receive it? Why did so many embrace it? Why did so many suffer for it? On the word of the apostles, who were, as their power showed, messengers from God. End of the quote. The key question in the ancient church, as in all subsequent centuries, for Newman is this. Has God spoken? Has God spoken? And if he has spoken, who are the appointed hearers of his word, so as to be now the spokespersons for God? He said, these are the key questions. Has God spoken? And who are the spokespersons that you can trust with regard to what he has said? That means that the apostles were nothing in themselves, but they were all things. They were an infallible authority as coming from God. He locates the apostolic credentials of Catholic faith. He says, no one can be a Catholic without a simple faith that what the church declares is God, in God's name, is God's word, and therefore true. The word of the church, spoken with the authority of the oracle of God, constitutes what is specific to Catholic faith and gives a definite coloration to the faith of Catholics. Other Christians also believe in many of the great truths that unite us, as we know, and that grounds ecumenism. But he will say that a Catholic faith knows that the oracles of God are appointed in the church, the Pope with the magisterium of the bishops. The Catholic view is that the object of faith is not simply certain articles contained in dumb documents, but the whole word of God, explicit and implicit, as dispensed by his living church. An aspect of this distinctiveness is the principle that the believer assents to all that is revealed and taught by the church. I quote him again. No one could say, I will choose my religion for myself. I will believe this. I will not believe that. One of the 17th century Irish martyrs, he was a baker down in County Wexford. And when he was put before the tribunal, he was challenged, you see, about his part of his crime was that he was a Catholic believer and a very strong leader at a difficult time in our history. So the people in the tribunal were much more learned. This man was illiterate. So they tried to confuse him. And at a certain stage he says, the points you bring up, the arguments you make, I'm not able to answer them all. But I believe the faith that my mother, the church, has. That faith is the faith that I assent to, whatever she has. And that was allowed, apparently, in the investigation of His Holiness as a perfect Catholic faith. So it's the faith of the church in its depth and its richness. And there is no need, therefore, to remind the reader that what Newman would be likely to say today with regard to the phenomenon of a la carte Catholicism, you know, pick and choose. He would consider that that is, in fact, already a loss of what Catholic faith is about. So now that's the first thing then, a Catholic definition of faith. Now the next thing is, I'm going to look a little bit at this principle. For Newman, faith is a principle of personal action. Faith is not something theoretical. If you have faith, it becomes a source of decision and of action in your life. So faith is something, yes, that our mind is involved in, but especially our will and our choices and our life. He says he had this principle, as we saw, holiness before peace. His was going to be a faith rooted in revealed truths, but he stresses the fact that the New Testament sees in faith the chosen instrument connecting heaven and earth. And he stresses the fact that that faith should lead also to practical action. Still, faith is only a beginning. It has to advance to hope and charity or love. It is not animated, as it were, if it is not animated by the greatest of the theological virtues, charity, faith can become defective. In fact, it can easily decline into superstition. Faith may even justify bigotry or fanaticism, as church history tragically witnesses. It needs a safeguard, and since faith is a test of a man's heart, the safeguard is logically a right state of heart. And that is why it is love which forms it out of the root chaos into an image of Christ. Or in scholastic language, faith is formed by charity. It's this fides caritate formata. Faith is really ultimately shaped and formed by love. And this prepares the way for this famous principle of Newman: we believe because we love. Anyway, therefore, it becomes a principle of action. A person who has authentic faith will assess life, look at life, make his decisions, choose his values very much in the light of the revealed world of God, which he accesses through faith. Okay, so it is not something, therefore, merely intellectual, merely contemplative. It is always a source of inspiration. Now, then, I want to move on then to looking at faith in Newman as an Anglican, how he saw faith there. During his early life, he's saying the Anglican period of his life, he saw a movement beginning around him that he called religious liberalism. Now, remember, Newman was a great advocate of liberal education, that is, an education that expanded the mind. And, of course, he's a founder of a university, the famous Catholic University in the 1850s in Ireland, which is the forerunner of University College Dublin. But he therefore talks about liberal education. However, liberalism in religion, though, was something that he fought against. And when he was made a cardinal by Pope Leo XIII, he says that this: "I rejoice to say, to one great mischief I have from the first opposed myself. For 30, 40, 50 years, I have resisted to the best of my powers the spirit of liberalism in religion. Never did Holy Church need champions against it more sorely than now, when alas it is an error overspreading as a snare the whole earth." What was this religious liberalism that he fought against all his life? It's this: liberalism in religion is the doctrine that there is no positive truth in religion. It's the belief that one creed is as good as another. It is inconsistent with the recognition of any religion as true. It teaches that all are to be tolerated, for all are matters of opinion. Revealed religion is not a truth, but a sentiment. It's a taste. It's not an objective fact, not miraculous. And it is the right of each individual to make it say just what strikes his fancy. So, it is the kind of belief that there are no truths in religion. Or if there are, they're the ones that you make up yourself. You don't receive reality and the actual truths of God at all. Now, this concerned them so much that he started addressing this question then of faith and reason very strongly. From about 1824, remember 1801 he's born, 1824, and for the next 20 years he thinks out this kind of issue and this question. And the talks were delivered in the University of Oxford, they're called therefore the Oxford University Sermons, and they have been classified by no less a man than Cardinal Avery Dulles as perhaps the finest treatment of the subject of faith and reason for the modern world ever delivered. That was his verdict, and he was also a great Newman scholar. For Newman, he talks a little bit about how a person comes to faith. And the way he describes is not the way it's described at all in the textbooks, in the standard kind of textbooks. Newman believes a lot that the actual way people think and reason is unlike how our thinking and reasoning is described often in philosophical courses, epistemology and all of these. That in fact, he says, people think in a different way. So he proposes this way as the way that people come to actually know the truth of revelation, know the truth of doctrine, and therefore have authentic faith. And I'm just going to mention the stages in it. You can look them up yourself if you want to. The first stage is conscience. Newman says all men and women are gifted with a conscience. It's the first teacher, and it's the greatest teacher, but also the weakest teacher. I'm quoting him. The first teacher inside us, but also the weakest teacher. But conscience is, he says, it's two things. It is a moral judgment. This is right, that is wrong. And it is also a moral imperative. Do what is right, avoid what is wrong. And he says the second one is the voice of God in us, if we pay attention to it. Because if I say yes to what is good, I feel happy. If I say yes to what is no, I feel unhappy. There is a kind of a moral judgment that comes at me, inside me. I feel unhappy some way. I'm being addressed. Someone is speaking to me. And he says, in nature itself, the conscience is a voice that speaks in us. We feel ourselves to be spoken to. So he says, listen to your conscience. Which is hard to, because he says it is unkind. It tells the truth. It praises you or it condemns you. You know, it complains against you or it approves of what you're doing. But he says if you do that, you find yourself, you know, being on the wavelength of the true and the good. Now, the second stage then is what he called antecedent probabilities. First principles. First principles. He says that a person, each man or woman, has a set of their principles. There's a story told about two of my colleagues and me who had a great argument once. And one of them had a great sense of humor. So in all the tender and good terms, he said, now these, John, are my principles. If you don't like them, I'll change them. he had such a sense of humor, you know. However, like that, we all have a set of first principles. What do I mean? Things like, say a man or a woman in their heart thinks, it is good to give. It's good. It's important to be polite. Pay your debts. But suppose somebody said, it's not good to give. Get what you can. Enjoy life. Make it. Don't give. Think of yourself. They're very different types of person. You know, Newman is very concrete here. And he says that the set of first principles that are in a person's heart are very, very influential on my journey. You know, the first set of principles. And often a person, he says, doesn't know his or her own first principles. Because they're very deep. But he says they are the man, they are the woman. You are what you really believe deep down in your heart. That's what you are. Now, a lot of hermeneutical theory. You know, I don't know if you heard the story about there was a course given in Ireland once on religious studies. It was run during a whole winter, and I think it was down in a county called Offaly in Ireland. And this very learned professor come, and he kept talking about hermeneutics. And there were two men sitting in the front row, and one of them had hard of hearing, and he was heard to say, reaching across, Herman who? Hermeneutics. But anyway, modern hermeneutics is very much aware of first principles in a person because they are the selectors. What comes to me, what's proposed to me, is normally processed through them. I hear what I want to hear. I don't hear what I don't want to hear. If my principles are generous, loving, then I hear that and I like it and I go with it. If they're not, if my first principles are get what you can, enjoy life, always get your own back. Talk only, you know, don't forgive. You know, take things like that. Then you don't like the other kind of message. So therefore, conscience, first principles, and thirdly then, antecedent probabilities. It's a strange kind of word in a way, but probability. Probabilities is a topic that philosophy and mathematics and all today is very interested in. For Newman, antecedent probabilities was the sense of likelihood. What is likely? And so he actually probability, these antecedent probabilities here are the kind of likelihoods that a person has with regard to the truth of things that are coming towards them. If the person has a sense of likelihood that something is likely to be the case, then you see they tend to go with it that way. And he would say, for example, that you can present facts, like the church often presents the facts of that there being holy people, as a sign of faith. Miracles actually happen as signs of faith. But Newman would say that these are not the most powerful arguments at all. It is what a person feels to be likely in their heart with regard to something that actually pushes them on. So after those three stages then of conscience, first principles, probability, then you can arrive then at the stage of feeling that maybe I ought to believe, that I should believe. However, then he says that to actually believe, you need then the push in the back of grace. You can come to the edge of saying, I believe. I believe in one holy Catholic Apostolic Church. You come to the edge of it. But you cannot actually go in to faith without the push of grace that comes at that moment. Okay, now then, that then gives you something of his idea of the journey to faith, the journey of the person, the concrete person, coming to faith in those great works, those great talks on faith called the Oxford University Sermons. I'm going to come now in my last section here to another work that he wrote. You would think that having done all that work, he would have felt that I have exhausted the topic of faith and reason. But he got into a dialogue with a number of people. One of them was a great scientist at the time, James Froude. And this scientist, he was an Anglican, but he lost his faith under his sense of the need for evidences to prove his faith. And Newman felt that I now have to try to deal with this question again. So in the light of that experience of Froude losing his faith because he felt he couldn't find evidences for faith that would be as strong as evidences in science, that Newman then started thinking again, and he spends 20 years almost again composing a work that is an extraordinary work and that has so many dimensions to it, A Grammar of Assent. That work itself, he spent 20 years writing it. When it was published in 1870, all the copies were bought the first day it came out. And it is considered an exceptional work. Basically, I'll just talk a bit about it rather than read my notes, because I'm conscious of the way time moves on. His big contention there is this. You can believe, but you cannot understand fully. And of course, faith is believing what you don't fully understand. But it is all right. It is reasonable to believe what you cannot fully understand. The Trinity, the Incarnation, the resurrection of the body, the real presence. You can believe what you cannot fully understand. And also, secondly, you can believe what you cannot fully prove. What you cannot fully prove. Now here, of course, you're using terms, evidences and proofs. So you can believe what you cannot fully understand. So he would say that the human mind is so constructed that you can have an image of, say, a doctrine of faith. Say, the resurrection of the body. A doctrine like that. You can have an image of it. You can have, he uses the word apprehension of it, to apprehend it. You can have that picture of the reality in your mind, knowing, of course, that because it is mystery, it is always much vaster than what you can think, what you can imagine. And of course, for Newman, imagination is also very important in how we grow in our sense of the greatness of the mystery itself. So you can have a certain understanding, apprehension, kind of grasp, image of what the mystery is saying. And because it is mystery, you cannot have more than that. You cannot have more, because then you would be equal to the mystery. But then, okay, you have a certain image of it, then can you believe what you cannot fully prove? And here he works out what he calls the accumulation and convergence of evidences. He says there are evidences, but they're not the evidences that are a kind of that force you. They're the evidences that gather together, that converge, that grow, and that eventually, you know, are really, really convincing, you know, that this is the truth. There he's been a lot autobiographical, because he himself has come to believe in the Catholic Church largely in that fashion, and he was very attentive to his own experiences, you see, of faith. So basically, there would be experience, then the apprehension of something, that kind of grasp of it in some way, then there would be a certain gathering together and accumulation of evidences to the point where, through what he called illative sense, it's an unusual word that he uses, the illative sense, the inductive sense, that you would be certain, at a certain moment you'd be certain, this is true, this is the truth, it is true. And not only that, but he would say that is in fact the way in which great converts come to faith. So if, for example, you were to read the story of, say, a man like Thomas Merton, or read any of these great converts that you like, maybe a great figure, like I think of Merton, for example, who wrote the beautiful autobiography, A Seven-Story Mountain. That's how he comes to faith, in a way. He comes through a certain series of images of Christ, of God, then a certain kind of evidences that gather for him and that eventually convince him. I can think of a great Irish thinker, C.S. Lewis, who became an Anglican, high Anglican, was professor of English in Oxford. Surprised by Joy is his autobiography. But again, when you read that, you see the story of how he comes quickly. And then afterwards, he spends more time even trying to explain it. So Newman tries to put shape on this. And he did it so well that Pope John Paul, in his great encyclical, Faith and Reason, he says that in the Western world, in the last 300 or 400 years, among the five great thinkers on faith and reason, I would list Cardinal Newman, and he lists him as number one in the Western world as one of the great original thinkers about this question. Now, it is difficult, but it is also very concrete. It is mysterious, because it is mysterious for ourselves even to understand how we remember. Memory is a huge mystery, isn't it? How we think, how we understand. I'm going to make then conclude with some comments then. Newman read the tendency of his day as increasingly a propensity to deny the proofs of revelation. Am I not right, he says, in saying that both the Abbé de Lamennais and the Abbé Bortin have gone wrong in this very point? He saw in this the most fatal suicidal act by believers. Why? It implies an opposition between reason and faith, or at least encourages the notion that the intellect of the world is naturally and properly on the side of unbelief. From his own itinerary of growth into what he called Catholic fullness, he knew that faith was at one and the same time most human and most divine. Most human in that it corresponded to the mysteriousness of our human existence, and most divine in that it brought us into contact with the God of Jesus Christ and his living church. That blessed vision of peace, as he called it, in the final paragraph of an essay on development, impressed upon him an existential imperative. Time is short, eternity is long. True faith, he writes in 1838, is what may be called colourless, like air or water. It is but the medium through which the soul sees Christ. Such faith is a firm assent. It is a certainty greater than any other certainty, and this is wrought in the mind by the grace of God and by it alone. So, a few comments. He brings out the rationality of faith as both act and content. If he did not attempt this project, he believed his life would be unfinished. That's why when he finished all the work on, the Oxford work on faith and reason, he felt he had to begin again, and that's the idea, the grammar of assent. secondly, Newman expands our idea of reason. He enlarges the sense of reason. And this is part of his greatness, I think, as a thinker, that he saw that reason through its use, to one of its deployments in the physical sciences was being reduced, and that anything else was being considered, you know, semi-irrational or irrational. So he fights to extend the width and the depth and the true meaning of reason. Thirdly, he sets out to forge a new language in theology and philosophy to talk about faith and reason and their interaction. So you find topics like weak and strong reason. He's the first person that I know of to have used the term weak reason. It goes back to 1839 in him. Weak reason, real and notional apprehension, accumulation and convergence of probabilities, antecedent probabilities, formal, informal and natural inference, illusive sense, the unconditional, and others. He develops this a language even with which to talk about this difficult area of faith and reason. And for him, again, I repeat that lovely principle. For Newman, faith makes you most human and connects you to God at the same time. So it is always a kind of Christological. It's a kind of the mystery of Christ happening in us. He's enhanced the theology of the act of faith in a manner reminiscent of St. Augustine's handling of the theology of Trinity in the 5th century. And of course then he does a very careful analysis of our cognitional structures, of what we are doing when we are knowing. I alluded to this yesterday evening. What we are doing when we are thinking and knowing, and why that is authentic thinking and knowing, and what we know when we do it. I'll end with this. In the process of his lifelong project, Faith and Reason, he recovered the range of human reasoning, spelled out the gift quality of faith, and showed its reasonableness against both rationalists and fideists. In doing so, he forged a rich philosophical and theological vocabulary, which still awaits appropriate deployment. His first account of the relation between faith and reason in the university sermons caused more than a little anxiety later on within some schools of theology in the Catholic Church. However, a little over a century and a half later, a major papal encyclical gladly mentions him as first among those more recent thinkers who in the Western context in modern times have shown through courageous research the fruitfulness of the relationship between the Word of God and philosophy. His motto, one of his mottos was, Ex umbris et imaginibus in veritatem, from shadows and images into truth. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Norris. Your lecture has enabled us to continue to be fascinated by John Henry Newman, because like him, we too are on a journey which leads to marvelous panoramas. Faith leading to decision, faith which helps us in our encounter with mystery. So I believe that, and I hope that for all of us, your lecture has been an invitation to read Newman, to discover Newman even more, to discover what lies at the very heart of this great man, this original thinker, this convert, and this pioneer of Vatican II. So I thank you on behalf of those present here. Tomorrow, Professor Norris will be lecturing on steps towards a Trinitarian ontology in the morning at 11 a.m. in Maths and Physics, Room 101. Unfortunately, there is no time for questions because the students have a lecture at 7:15, but we thank you for your very insightful observations on Newman. Thank you.
You have just listened to a talk organized by the Ada Studentità Teologia entitled Faith and Reason According to Cardinal Newman. This talk was delivered by Reverend Professor Thomas Norris.